Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Chapter 15 of The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Bruce Peary. Chapter 15. At first, Miss Newson's budding beauty was not regarded with much interest by anybody in Casterbridge. Donald Farfrae's gaze, it is true, was now attracted by the mayor's so-called stepdaughter, but he was only one. The truth is that she was but a poor illustrative instance of the prophet Baruch's sly definition, "the virgin that loveth to go gay." When she walked abroad, she seemed to be occupied with an inner chamber of ideas, and to have slight need for visible objects. She formed curious resolves on checking gay fancies in the matter of clothes, because it was inconsistent with her past life to blossom gaudily the moment she had become possessed of money. But nothing is more insidious than the evolution of wishes from mere fancies, and of wants from mere wishes. Henchard gave Elizabeth Jane a box of delicately tinted gloves one spring day. She wanted to wear them to show her appreciation of his kindness, but she had no bonnet that would harmonize. As an artistic indulgence, she thought she would have such a bonnet. When she had a bonnet that would go with the gloves, she had no dress that would go with the bonnet. It was now absolutely necessary to finish. She ordered the requisite article, and found that she had no sunshade to go with the dress. In for a penny, in for a pound, she bought the sunshade, and the whole structure was at last complete. Everybody was attracted, and some said that her bygone simplicity was the art that conceals art, the delicate imposition of Rochefoucauld. She had produced an effect, a contrast, and it had been done on purpose. As a matter of fact, this was not true, but it had its result, for as soon as Casterbridge thought her artful, it thought her worth notice. "It is the first time in my life that I have been so much admired," she said to herself, "though perhaps it is by those whose admiration is not worth having." But Donald Farfrae admired her too, and altogether the time was an exciting one. Sex had never before asserted itself in her so strongly, for in former days she had perhaps been too impersonally human to be distinctively feminine. After an unprecedented success one day, she came indoors, went upstairs, and leant upon her bed face downwards, quite forgetting the possible creasing and damage. "Good heaven," she whispered, "can it be? Here am I setting up as the town beauty?" When she had thought it over, her usual fear of exaggerating appearances engendered a deep sadness. "There is something wrong in all this," she mused. "If they only knew what an unfinished girl I am, that I can't talk Italian or use globes or show any of the accomplishments they learn at boarding schools, how they would despise me. Better sell all this finery and buy myself grammar books and dictionaries and a history of all the philosophies." She looked from the window and saw Henchard and Farfrae in the hay yard talking, with that impetuous cordiality on the mayor's part and genial modesty on the younger man's that was now so generally observable in their intercourse. Friendship between man and man, what a rugged strength there was in it, as evinced by these two. And yet the seed that was to lift the foundation of this friendship was at that moment taking root in a chink of its structure. It was about 6 o'clock. The men were dropping off homeward, one by one. The last to leave was a round-shouldered, blinking young man of 19 or 20, whose mouth fell ajar on the slightest provocation, seemingly because there was no chin to support it. Henchard called aloud to him as he went out of the gate, "Here, Abel Whittle." Whittle turned and ran back a few steps.
"Yes, sir,"
he said, in breathless deprecation, as if he knew what was coming next.
"Once more, be in time tomorrow morning. You see what's to be done, and you hear what I say, and you know I'm not going to be trifled with any longer."
"Yes, sir."
Then Abel Whittle left, and Henchart and Farfrae, and Elizabeth saw no more of them. Now there was good reason for this command on Henchard's part. Poor Abel, as he was called, had an inveterate habit of oversleeping himself and coming late to his work. His anxious will was to be among the earliest, but if his comrades omitted to pull the string that he always tied round his great toe and left hanging out the window for that purpose, his will was as wind. He did not arrive in time. As he was often second-hand at the hay-weighing, or at the crane which lifted the sacks, or was one of those who had to accompany the wagons into the country to fetch away stacks that had been purchased, this affliction of Abel's was productive of much inconvenience. For 2 mornings in the present week he had kept the others waiting nearly an hour. Hence Henchard's threat. It now remained to be seen what would happen tomorrow.
6 o'clock struck, and there was no Whittle. At 6:30 Henchard entered the yard. The wagon was horsed that Abel was to accompany, and the other man had been waiting 20 minutes. Then Henchard swore, and Whittle, coming up breathless at that instant, the corn factor turned on him and declared with an oath that this was the last time, that if he were behind once more, by God he would come and drag him out of bed.
"There is summat wrong in my make, your worshipful," said Abel, "especially in the inside, whereas my poor dumb brain gets as dead as a clod afore I've said my few scrags of prayers. Yes, it came on as a stripling, just afore I'd got man's wages, whereas I never enjoy my bed at all, for no sooner do I lie down than I be asleep, and afore I be awake I be up. I've fretted my gizzard green about it, maester, but what can I do? Now last night, afore I went to bed, I only had a scantling of cheese, and—"
"I don't want to hear it," roared Henchard. "Tomorrow the wagons must start at 4, and if you're not here, stand clear. I'll mortify thy flesh for thee."
"But let me clear up my points, your worshipful." Henchard turned away. "He asked me, and he questioned me, and then he wouldn't hear my points," said Abel to the yard in general. "Now I shall twitch like a moment hand all night to night for fear o' him."
The journey to be taken by the wagons next day was a long one into Blackmoor Vale, and at 4 o'clock lanterns were moving about the yard, but Abel was missing. Before either of the other men could run to Abel's and warn him, Henchard appeared in the garden doorway.
"Where's Abel Whittle? Not come after all I've said? Now I'll carry out my word by my blessed fathers. Nothing else will do him any good. I'm going up that way."
Henchard went off, entered Abel's house, a little cottage in Back Street, the door of which was never locked because the inmates had nothing to lose. Reaching Whittle's bedside, the corn factor shouted a bass note so vigorously that Abel started up instantly, and beholding Henchard standing over him, was galvanized into spasmodic movements which had not much relation to getting on his clothes.
"Out of bed, sir, and off to the granary, or you leave my employ to-day. 'Tis to teach ye a lesson. March on, never mind your breeches."
The unhappy Whittle threw on his sleeve waistcoat and managed to get into his boots at the bottom of the stairs, while Henchard thrust his hat over his head. Whittle then trotted on down Back Street, Henchard walking sternly behind. Just at this time, Farfrae, who had been to Henchard's house to look for him, came out of the back gate and saw something white fluttering in the morning gloom, which he soon perceived to be part of Abel's shirt that showed below his waistcoat.
"For mercy's sake, what object's this?" said Farfrae, following Abel into the yard,
Henchard being some way in the rear by this time.
"Ye see, Mr. Farfrae," gibbered Abel with a resigned smile of terror, "he said he'd mortify my flesh if so be I didn't get up sooner, and now he's a-doin' on it. You see, it can't be helped, Mr. Farfrae. Things do happen queer sometimes. Yes, I'll go to Blackmoor Vale half naked as I be, since he do command, but I shall kill myself afterwards. I can't outlive the disgrace, for the women folk will be looking out of their windows at my mortification all the way along, and laughing me to scorn as a man without breeches. You know how I feel such things, Maister Farfrae, and how forlorn thoughts get hold upon me. Yes, I shall do myself harm. I feel it coming on.
Get back home and slip on your breeches, and come to work like a man. If you go not, you'll hae your death standing there.
I'm afeard I mustn't. Mr. Henchard said—
I don't care what Mr. Henchard said, nor anybody else. 'Tis simple foolishness to do this. Go and dress yourself instantly, Whittle.
Hello, hello, said Henchard, coming up behind. Who's sending him back?
All the men looked towards Farfrae.
I am, said Donald. I say this joke has been carried far enough.
And I say it hasn't. Get up in the wagon, Whittle.
Not if I am manager, said Farfrae. He either goes home, or I march out of this yard for good.
Henchard looked at him with a face stern and red, but he paused for a moment, and their eyes met. Donald went up to him, for he saw in Henchard's look that he began to regret this.
Come, said Donald quietly, a man of your position should ken better, sir. It is tyrannical and no worthy of you.
'Tis not tyrannical, murmured Henchard like a sullen boy. It is to make him remember. He presently added, in a tone of one bitterly hurt, Why did you speak to me before them like that, Farfrae? You might have stopped till we were alone. Ah, I know why. I've told ye the secret of my life, fool that I was to do it, and you take advantage of me.
I had forgot it, said Farfrae simply.
Henchard looked on the ground, said nothing more, and turned away. During the day, Farfrae learnt from the men that Henchard had kept Abel's old mother in coals and snuff all the previous winter, which made him less antagonistic to the corn-factor. But Henchard continued moody and silent, and when one of the men inquired of him if some oats should be hoisted to an upper floor or not, he said shortly, "Ask Mr. Farfrae, he's master here." Morally, he was. There could be no doubt of it. Henchard, who had hitherto been the most admired man in his circle, was the most admired no longer. One day the daughters of a deceased farmer in Durnover wanted an opinion of the value of their haystack, and sent a messenger to ask Mr. Farfrae to oblige them with one. The messenger, who was a child, met in the yard not Farfrae, but Henchard.
"Very well," he said, "I'll come."
"But please, will Mr. Farfrae come?" said the child.
"I am going that way. Why, Mr. Farfrae?" said Henchard, with the fixed look of thought. "Why do people always want Mr. Farfrae?"
"I suppose because they like him so. That's what they say."
"Oh, I see. That's what they say, eh? They like him because he's cleverer than Mr. Henchard, and because he knows more. And, in short, Mr. Henchard can't hold a candle to him, eh?"
"Yes, that's just it, sir, some of it."
"Oh, there's more. Of course there's more. What, besides? Come, here's a sixpence for a fairing."
"And he's better tempered, and Henchard's a fool to him, they say. And when some of the women were a-walking home, they said, 'He's a diamond, he's a chap o' wax, he's the best, he's the horse for my money,' says they. And they said, 'He's the most understanding man of them two, by long chalks. I wish he was the master instead of Henchard,' they said."
"They'll talk any nonsense," Henchard replied with covered gloom. "Well, you can go now. And I am coming to value the hay, do you hear? I."
The boy departed, and Henchard murmured, "Wish he were master here, do they?" He went towards Durnover. On his way, he overtook Farfrae. They walked on together, Henchard looking mostly on the ground.
"You're no yoursel the day?" Donald inquired.
"Yes, I'm very well," said Henchard.
"But ye are a bit down. Surely ye are down. Why, there's nothing to be angry about. 'Tis splendid stuff that we've got from Blackmoor Vale. By the by, the people in Durnover want their hay valued."
"Yes, I am going there."
"I'll go with ye."
As Henchard did not reply, Donald practised a piece of music, sotto voce, till, getting near the bereaved people's door, he stopped himself with, "Ah, as their father is dead, I won't go on with such as that. How could I forget?" "Do you care so very much about hurting folks' feelings?" observed Henchard with a half-sneer. "You do, I know, especially mine."
"I am sorry if I have hurt yours, sir," replied Donald, standing still, with a second expression of the same sentiment in the regretfulness of his face. "Why should you say it? Think it."
The cloud lifted from Henchard's brow, and as Donald finished, the corn merchant turned to him, regarding his breast rather than his face.
"I have been hearing things that vexed me," he said. "'Twas that made me short in my manner, made me overlook what you really are. Now, I don't want to go in here about this hay. Farfrae, you can do it better than I. They sent for ye, too. I have to attend a meeting of the town council at 11, and 'tis drawing on for it."
They parted thus in renewed friendship, Donald forbearing to ask Henchard for meanings that were not very plain to him. On Henchard's part there was now, again, repose. And yet, whenever he thought of Farfrae, it was with a dim dread, and he often regretted that he had told the young man his whole heart and confided to him the secrets of his life. End of chapter 15.
Chapter 16 of The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Bruce Peary. Chapter 16. On this account Henchard's manner towards Farfrae insensibly became more reserved. He was courteous, too courteous, and Farfrae was quite surprised at the good breeding which now, for the first time, showed itself among the qualities of a man he had hitherto thought undisciplined, if warm and sincere. The corn-factor seldom or never again put his arm upon the young man's shoulder so as to nearly weigh him down with the pressure of mechanized friendship. He left off coming to Donald's lodgings and shouting into the passage, "Hoy, Farfrae, boy, come and have some dinner with us. Don't sit here in solitary confinement." But in the daily routine of their business there was little change. Thus their lives rolled on till a day of public rejoicing was suggested to the country at large in celebration of a national event that had recently taken place. For some time Casterbridge, by nature slow, made no response. Then one day Donald Farfrae broached the subject to Henchard by asking if he would have any objection to lend some rick cloths to himself and a few others who contemplated getting up an entertainment of some sort on the day named, and required a shelter for the same, to which they might charge admission at the rate of so much a head.
"Have as many cloths as you like," Henchard replied.
When his manager had gone about the business, Henchard was fired with emulation. It certainly had been very remiss of him, as mayor, he thought, to call no meeting ere this to discuss what should be done on this holiday. But Farfrae had been so cursed quick in his movements as to give old-fashioned people in authority no chance of the initiative. However, it was not too late, and on second thoughts he determined to take upon his own shoulders the responsibility of organizing some amusements, if the other councilmen would leave the matter in his hands. To this they quite readily agreed, the majority being fine old crusted characters who had a decided taste for living without worry. So Henchard set about his preparations for a really brilliant thing, such as should be worthy of the venerable town. As for Farfrae's little affair, Henchard nearly forgot it, except once now and then when, on it coming into his mind, he said to himself, "Charge admission at so much a head, just like a Scotchman, who is going to pay anything ahead?" The diversions which the mayor intended to provide were to be entirely free. He had grown so dependent upon Donald that he could scarcely resist calling him in to consult, but by sheer self-coercion he refrained. No, he thought, Farfrae would be suggesting such improvements in his damned luminous way that in spite of himself he, Henchard, would sink to the position of second fiddle and only scrape harmonies to his manager's talents. Everybody applauded the mayor's proposed entertainment, especially when it became known that he meant to pay for it all himself.
Close to the town was an elevated green spot surrounded by an ancient square earthwork. Earthworks, square and not square, were as common as blackberries hereabout, a spot whereon the Casterbridge people usually held any kind of merry-making, meeting, or sheep-fair that required more space than the streets would afford. On one side it sloped to the River Frome, and from any point a view was obtained of the country round for many miles. This pleasant upland was to be the scene of Henchard's exploit. He advertised about the town, in long posters of a pink colour, that games of all sorts would take place here, and set to work a little battalion of men under his own eye. They erected greasy poles for climbing, with smoked hams and local cheeses at the top. They placed hurdles in rows for jumping over. Across the river they laid a slippery pole, with a live pig of the neighborhood tied at the other end, to become the property of the man who could walk over and get it. There were also provided wheelbarrows for racing, donkeys for the same, a stage for boxing, wrestling, and drawing blood generally, sacks for jumping in. Moreover, not forgetting his principles, Henchard provided a mammoth tea, of which everybody who lived in the borough was invited to partake without payment. The tables were laid parallel with the inner slope of the rampart, and awnings were stretched overhead. Passing to and fro, the mayor beheld the unattractive exterior of Farfrae's erection in the West Walk, rick-cloths of different sizes and colours being hung up to the arching trees without any regard to appearance. He was easy in his mind now, for his own preparations far transcended these. The morning came. The sky, which had been remarkably clear down to within a day or two, was overcast, and the weather threatening, the wind having an unmistakable hint of water in it. Henchard wished he had not been quite so sure about the continuance of a fair season, but it was too late to modify or postpone, and the proceedings went on. At 12 o'clock the rain began to fall, small and steady, commencing and increasing so insensibly that it was difficult to state exactly when dry weather ended or wet established itself. In the end, the slight moisture resolved itself into a monotonous smiting of earth by heaven, in torrents to which no end could be prognosticated. A number of people had heroically gathered in the field, but by 3 o'clock Henchard discerned that his project was doomed to end in failure. The hams at the top of the poles dripped watered smoke in the form of a brown liquor, the pig shivered in the wind, the grain of the deal tables showed through the sticking tablecloths, for the awning allowed the rain to drift under at its will, and to enclose the sides at this hour seemed a useless undertaking. The landscape over the river disappeared. The wind played on the tent cords in aeolian improvisations, and at length rose to such a pitch that the whole erection slanted to the ground, those who had taken shelter within it having to crawl out on their hands and knees. But towards 6 the storm abated, and a drier breeze shook the moisture from the grass bents. It seemed possible to carry out the programme after all. The awning was set up again, the band was called out from its shelter and ordered to begin, and where the tables had stood a place was cleared for dancing. "But where are the folk?" said Henchard, after the lapse of half an hour, during which time only 2 men and a woman had stood up to dance. "The shops are all shut. Why don't they come?" "They are at Farfrae's affair in the West Walk," answered a councilman who stood in the field with the mayor. "A few, I suppose, but where are the body of 'em?" "All out of doors are there." "Then the more fools they." Henchard walked away moodily. One or two young fellows gallantly came to climb the poles to save the hams from being wasted, but as there were no spectators and the whole scene presented the most melancholy appearance, Henchard gave orders that the proceedings were to be suspended, and the entertainment closed, the food to be distributed among the poor people of the town. In a short time nothing was left in the field but a few hurdles, the tents, and the poles.
Henchard returned to his house, had tea with his wife and daughter, and then walked out. It was now dusk. He soon saw that the tendency of all promenaders was towards a particular spot in the walks, and eventually proceeded thither himself. The notes of a stringed band came from the enclosure that Farfrae had erected, the pavilion, as he called it, and when the mayor reached it he perceived that a gigantic tent had been ingeniously constructed without poles or ropes. The densest point of the avenue of sycamores had been selected, where the boughs made a closely interlaced vault overhead. To these boughs the canvas had been hung, and a barrel roof was the result. The end, towards the wind, was enclosed. The other end was open. Henchard went round and saw the interior. In form it was like the nave of a cathedral, with one gable removed, but the scene within was anything but devotional. A reel or fling of some sort was in progress, and the usually sedate Farfrae was in the midst of the other dancers, in the costume of a wild Highlander, flinging himself about and spinning to the tune. For a moment Henchard could not help laughing. Then he perceived the immense admiration for the Scotchman that revealed itself in the women's faces, and when this exhibition was over and a new dance proposed, and Donald had disappeared for a time to return in his natural garments, he had an unlimited choice of partners, every girl being in a coming-on disposition towards one who so thoroughly understood the poetry of motion as he. All the town crowded to the walk, such a delightful idea of a ballroom never having occurred to the inhabitants before. Among the rest of the onlookers were Elizabeth and her mother, the former thoughtful yet much interested, her eyes beaming with a longing, lingering light, as if nature had been advised by Correggio in their creation. The dancing progressed with unabated spirit, and Henchard walked and waited till his wife should be disposed to go home. He did not care to keep in the light, and when he went into the dark it was worse, for there he heard remarks of a kind which were becoming too frequent. "Mr. Henchard's rejoicings couldn't say good morning to this," said one. "A man must be a headstrong stunpole to think folk would go up to that bleak place to-day." The other answered that people said it was not only in such things as those that the mayor was wanting. Where would his business be if it were not for this young fellow? 'Twas verily fortune sent him to Henchard. His accounts were like a bramblewood when Mr. Farfrae came. He used to reckon his sacks by chalk strokes all in a row like garden palings, measure his ricks by stretching with his arms, weigh his trusses by a lift, judge his hay by a chaw, and settle the price with a curse. But now this accomplished young man does it all by ciphering and mensuration. Then the wheat, that sometimes used to taste so strong a mice when made into bread that people could fairly tell the breed, Farfrae has a plan for purifying, so that nobody would dream the smallest four-legged beast had walked over it once. Oh, yes, everybody is full of him, and the care Mr. Henchard has to keep him, to be sure," concluded this gentleman. "But he won't do it for long, good now," said the other. "No," said Henchard to himself behind the tree, "or if he do, he'll be honeycombed clean out of all the character and standing that he's built up in these 18 year." He went back to the dancing pavilion. Farfrae was footing a quaint little dance with Elizabeth Jane, an old country thing, the only one she knew, and though he considerately toned down his movements to suit her demurer gait, the pattern of the shining little nails in the soles of his boots became familiar to the eyes of every bystander. The tune had enticed her into it, being a tune of a busy, vaulting, leaping sort, some low notes on the silver string of each fiddle, then a skipping on the small, like running up and down ladders. Miss MacLeod of Ayr was its name, so Mr. Farfrae had said, and that it was very popular in his own country. It was soon over, and the girl looked at Henchard for approval, but he did not give it. He seemed not to see her. "Look here, Farfrae," he said, like one whose mind was elsewhere, "I'll go to Port Bredy Great Market to-morrow myself. You can stay and put things right in your clothes-box.
and recover strength to your knees after your vagaries." He planted on Donald an antagonistic glare that had begun as a smile. Some other townsmen came up, and Donald drew aside. "What's this, Henchard?" said Alderman Tubber, applying his thumb to the corn-factor like a cheese-taster. "An opposition randy to yours, eh? Jack's as good as his master, eh? Cut ye out quite, hasn't he?" "You see, Mr. Henchard," said the lawyer, another good-natured friend, "where you made the mistake was in going so far afield. You should have taken a leaf out of his book, and have had your sports in a sheltered place like this. But you didn't think of it, you see, and he did, and that's where he's beat you." "He'll be top sawyer soon of you two, and carry all afore him," added jocular Mr. Tubber. "No," said Henchard gloomily, "he won't be that, because he's shortly going to leave me." He looked towards Donald, who had come near. "Mr. Farfrae's time as my manager is drawing to a close, isn't it, Farfrae?" The young man, who could now read the lines and folds of Henchard's strongly traced face as if they were clear verbal inscriptions, quietly assented. And when people deplored the fact and asked why it was, he simply replied that Mr. Henchard no longer required his help. Henchard went home, apparently satisfied. But in the morning, when his jealous temper had passed away, his heart sank within him at what he had said and done. He was the more disturbed when he found that this time Farfrae was determined to take him at his word. End of chapter 16. Chapter 17 of The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Bruce Peary. Chapter 17. Elizabeth Jane had perceived from Henchard's manner that in assenting to dance she had made a mistake of some kind. In her simplicity she did not know what it was, till a hint from a nodding acquaintance enlightened her. As the mayor's stepdaughter, she learnt, she had not been quite in her place in treading a measure amid such a mixed throng as filled the dancing pavilion. Thereupon her ears, cheeks, and chin glowed like live coals at the dawning of the idea that her tastes were not good enough for her position, and would bring her into disgrace. This made her very miserable, and she looked about for her mother. But Mrs. Henchard, who had less idea of conventionality than Elizabeth herself, had gone away, leaving her daughter to return at her own pleasure. The latter moved on into the dark, dense old avenues, or rather vaults of living woodwork, which ran along the town boundary, and stood reflecting. A man followed in a few minutes, and her face being towards the shine from the tent, he recognized her. It was Farfrae, just come from the dialogue with Henchard which had signified his dismissal. "And it's you, Miss Newson, and I've been looking for ye everywhere," he said, overcoming a sadness imparted by the estrangement with the corn merchant. "May I walk on with you as far as your street-corner?" She thought there might be something wrong in this, but did not utter any objection. So together they went on, first down the west walk, and then into the bowling walk, till Farfrae said, "It's like that I'm going to leave you soon." She faltered. "Why?" "Oh, as a mere matter of business, nothing more, but we'll not concern ourselves about it. It is for the best. I hoped to have another dance with you." She said she could not dance in any proper way. "Nay, but you do. It's the feeling for it rather than the learning of steps that makes pleasant dancers. I fear I offended your father by getting up this, and now perhaps I'll have to go to another part of the world altogether." This seemed such a melancholy prospect that Elizabeth Jane breathed a sigh, letting it off in fragments that he might not hear her. But darkness makes people truthful, and the Scotchman went on impulsively. Perhaps he had heard her after all. "I wish I was richer, Miss Newson, and your stepfather had not been offended. I would ask you something in a short time. Yes, I would ask you to-night. But that's not for me." What he would have asked her he did not say,
and instead of encouraging him she remained incompetently silent. Thus afraid one of another, they continued their promenade along the walls till they got near the bottom of the bowling walk. 20 steps further and the trees would end, and the street corner and lamps appear. In consciousness of this, they stopped. "I never found out who it was that sent us to Durnover Granary on a fool's errand that day," said Donald in his undulating tones. "Did ye ever know yourself, Miss Newson?"
"Never," said she.
"I wonder why they did it."
"For fun, perhaps?"
"Perhaps it was not for fun. It might have been that they thought they would like us to stay waiting there, talking to one another.
Aye, well, I hope you Casterbridge folk will not forget me if I go."
"That I'm sure we won't," she said earnestly. "I wish you wouldn't go at all."
They had got into the lamplight.
"Now I'll think over that," said Donald Farfrae. "And I'll not come up to your door, but part from you here, lest it make your father more angry still."
They parted, Farfrae returning into the dark bowling walk, and Elizabeth Jane going up the street. Without any consciousness of what she was doing, she started running with all her might till she reached her father's door.
"Oh, dear me, what am I at?" she thought, as she pulled up breathless.
Indoors she fell to conjecturing the meaning of Farfrae's enigmatic words about not daring to ask her what he fain would. Elizabeth, that silent, observing woman, had long noted how he was rising in favour among the townspeople, and, knowing Henchard's nature now, she had feared that Farfrae's days as manager were numbered, so that the announcement gave her little surprise. Would Mr. Farfrae stay in Casterbridge, despite his words and her father's dismissal? His occult breathings to her might be solvable by his course in that respect. The next day was windy, so windy that walking in the garden she picked up a portion of the draft of a letter on business in Donald Farfrae's writing, which had flown over the wall from the office. The useless scrap she took indoors, and began to copy the calligraphy, which she much admired. The letter began, "Dear Sir," and presently, writing on a loose slip, "Elizabeth Jane," she laid the latter over "Sir," making the phrase, "Dear Elizabeth Jane." When she saw the effect, a quick red ran up her face and warmed her through, though nobody was there to see what she had done. She quickly tore up the slip and threw it away. After this she grew cool and laughed at herself, walked about the room and laughed again, not joyfully, but distressfully, rather. It was quickly known in Casterbridge that Farfrae and Henchard had decided to dispense with each other. Elizabeth Jane's anxiety to know if Farfrae were going away from the town reached a pitch that disturbed her, for she could no longer conceal from herself the cause. At length the news reached her that he was not going to leave the place. A man following the same trade as Henchard, but on a very small scale, had sold his business to Farfrae, who was forthwith about to start as corn and hay merchant on his own account. Her heart fluttered when she heard of this step of Donald's, proving that he meant to remain, and yet would a man who cared one little bit for her have endangered his suit by setting up a business in opposition to Mr. Henchard's? Surely not, and it must have been a passing impulse only which had led him to address her so softly. To solve the problem whether her appearance on the evening of the dance were such as to inspire a fleeting love at first sight, she dressed herself up exactly as she had dressed then, the muslin, the spencer, the sandals, the parasol, and looked in the mirror. The picture glassed back was, in her opinion, precisely of such a kind as to inspire that fleeting regard, and no more. "Just enough to make him silly, and not enough to keep him so," she said luminously. And Elizabeth thought, in a much lower key, that by this time he had discovered how plain and homely was the informing spirit of that pretty outside. Hence, when she felt her heart going out to him, she would say to herself with a mock pleasantry that carried an ache with it, "No, no, Elizabeth Jane, such dreams are not for you."
She tried to prevent herself from seeing him and thinking of him, succeeding fairly well in the former attempt, in the latter not so completely. Henchard, who had been hurt at finding that Farfrae did not mean to put up with his temper any longer, was incensed beyond measure when he learnt what the young man had done as an alternative. It was in the town hall, after a council meeting, that he first became aware of Farfrae's coup for establishing himself independently in the town. And his voice might have been heard as far as the town pump, expressing his feelings to his fellow councilmen. These tones showed that, though under a long reign of self-control he had become mayor and churchwarden and what not, there was still the same unruly volcanic stuff beneath the rind of Michael Henchard as when he had sold his wife at Weydon Fair. "Well, he's a friend of mine, and I'm a friend of his. Or, if we are not, what are we? Odd send, if I've not been his friend, who has, I should like to know? Didn't he come here without a sound shoe to his foot? Didn't I keep him here? Help him to a living? Didn't I help him to money or whatever he wanted? I stuck out for no terms. I said, name your own price. I'd have shared my last crust with that young fellow at one time. I liked him so well. And now he's defied me. But damn him, I'll have a tussle with him now, at fair buying and selling, mind, at fair buying and selling. And if I can't overbid such a stripling as he, then I'm not worth a Varden. We'll show that we know our business as well as one here and there." His friends of the corporation did not specially respond. Henchard was less popular now than he had been when nearly 2 years before they had voted him to the chief magistracy on account of his amazing energy. While they had collectively profited by this quality of the corn factors, they had been made to wince individually on more than one occasion, so he went out of the hall and down the street alone. Reaching home, he seemed to recollect something with a sour satisfaction. He called Elizabeth Jane. Seeing how he looked when she entered, she appeared alarmed. "Nothing to find fault with," he said, observing her concern. "Only I want to caution you, my dear. That man, Farfrae, it is about him. I've seen him talking to you two or three times. He danced with thee at the rejoicings, and came home with thee. Now, now, no blame to you, but just hearken. Have you made him any foolish promise? Gone the least bit beyond sniff and snaff at all?"
"No, I have promised him nothing."
"Good. All's well that ends well. I particularly wish you not to see him again."
"Very well, sir."
"You promise?" She hesitated for a moment, and then said,
"Yes, if you much wish it."
"I do. He's an enemy to our house." When she had gone, he sat down and wrote in a heavy hand to Farfrae, thus: "Sir, I make request that henceforth you and my stepdaughter be as strangers to each other. She, on her part, has promised to welcome no more addresses from you, and I trust, therefore, you will not attempt to force them upon her. M. Henchard." One would almost have supposed Henchard to have had policy to see that no better modus vivendi could be arrived at with Farfrae than by encouraging him to become his son-in-law. But such a scheme for buying over a rival had nothing to recommend it to the mayor's headstrong faculties. With all domestic finesse of that kind, he was hopelessly at variance. Loving a man or hating him, his diplomacy was as wrong-headed as a buffalo's, and his wife had not ventured to suggest the course which she, for many reasons, would have welcomed gladly. Meanwhile, Donald Farfrae had opened the gates of commerce on his own account at a spot on Durnover Hill, as far as possible from Henchard's stores, and with every intention of keeping clear of his former friend and employer's customers. There was, it seemed to the younger man, room for both of them, and to spare. The town was small, but the corn and hay trade was proportionately large, and with his native sagacity he saw opportunity for a share of it. So determined was he to do nothing which would seem like trade antagonism to the mayor, that he refused his first customer, a large farmer of good repute, because Henchard and this man had dealt together within the preceding 3 months. "He was once my friend," said Farfrae, "and it's not for me to take business from him. I am sorry to disappoint you, but I cannot hurt the trade of a man who's been so kind to me." In spite of this praiseworthy course, the Scotchman's trade increased. Whether it were that his northern energy was an overmastering force among the easy-going Wessex worthies, or whether it was sheer luck, the fact remained that whatever he touched, he prospered in. Like Jacob in Padan Aram, he would no sooner humbly limit himself to the ring-straked and spotted exceptions of trade than the ring-straked and spotted would multiply and prevail. But most probably luck had little to do with it. "Character is fate," said Novalis, and Farfrae's character was just the reverse of Henchard's, who might not inaptly be described as Faust has been described, as a vehement, gloomy being who had quitted the ways of vulgar men without light to guide him on a better way. Farfrae duly received the request to discontinue attentions to Elizabeth Jane. His acts of that kind had been so slight that the request was almost superfluous. Yet he had felt a considerable interest in her, and after some cogitation he decided that it would be as well to enact no Romeo part just then, for the young girl's sake no less than his own. Thus the incipient attachment was stifled down. A time came when, avoid collision with his former friend as he might, Farfrae was compelled, in sheer self-defense, to close with Henchard in mortal commercial combat. He could no longer parry the fierce attacks of the latter by simple avoidance. As soon as their war of prices began, everybody was interested, and some few guessed the end. It was in some degree northern insight matched against southern doggedness, the dirk against the cudgel, and Henchard's weapon was one which, if it did not deal ruin at the first or second stroke, left him afterwards well nigh at his antagonist's mercy. Almost every Saturday they encountered each other amid the crowd of farmers which thronged about the marketplace in the weekly course of their business. Donald was always ready, and even anxious, to say a few friendly words, but the mayor invariably gazed stormfully past him, like one who had endured and lost on his account, and could in no sense forgive the wrong. Nor did Farfrae's snubbed manner of perplexity at all appease him. The large farmers, corn merchants, millers, auctioneers, and others, each had an official stall in the corn-market room, with their names painted thereon. And when, to the familiar series of Henchard, Everdeen, Shiner, Darton, and so on, was added one inscribed Farfrae, in staring new letters, Henchard was stung into bitterness. Like Bellerophon, he wandered away from the crowd, cankered in soul. From that day Donald Farfrae's name was seldom mentioned in Henchard's house. If at breakfast or dinner Elizabeth Jane's mother inadvertently alluded to her favourite's movements, the girl would implore her by a look to be silent, and her husband would say, "What, are you too my enemy?" End of chapter 17. Chapter 18 of The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Bruce Peary. Chapter 18. There came a shock which had been foreseen for some time by Elizabeth, as the box passenger foresees the approaching jerk from some channel across the highway. Her mother was ill, too unwell to leave her room. Henchard, who treated her kindly, except in moments of irritation, sent at once for the richest, busiest doctor, whom he supposed to be the best. Bedtime came, and they burnt a light all night. In a day or two she rallied. Elizabeth, who had been staying up, did not appear at breakfast on the second morning, and Henchard sat down alone. He was startled to see a letter for him from Jersey, in a writing he knew too well,
and had expected least to behold again. He took it up in his hands and looked at it as at a picture, a vision, a vista of past enactments, and then he read it as an unimportant finale to conjecture. The writer said that she at length perceived how impossible it would be for any further communications to proceed between them, now that his remarriage had taken place. That such reunion had been the only straightforward course open to him, she was bound to admit. On calm reflection, therefore, she went on, I quite forgive you for landing me in such a dilemma, remembering that you concealed nothing before our ill-advised acquaintance, and that you really did set before me, in your grim way, the fact of there being a certain risk in intimacy with you, slight as it seemed to be after 15 or 16 years of silence on your wife's part. I thus look upon the whole as a misfortune of mine, and not a fault of yours. So that, Michael, I must ask you to overlook those letters with which I pestered you day after day in the heat of my feelings. They were written whilst I thought your conduct to me cruel, but now I know more particulars of the position you were in, I see how inconsiderate my reproaches were. Now you will, I am sure, perceive that the one condition which will make any future happiness possible for me is that the past connection between our lives be kept secret outside this isle. Speak of it I know you will not, and I can trust you not to write of it. One safeguard more remains to be mentioned, that no writings of mine, or trifling articles belonging to me, should be left in your possession through neglect or forgetfulness. To this end, may I request you to return to me any such you may have, particularly the letters written in the first abandonment of feeling. For the handsome sum you forwarded to me as a plaster to the wound, I heartily thank you. I am now on my way to Bristol to see my only relative. She is rich, and I hope will do something for me. I shall return through Casterbridge and Budmouth, where I shall take the packet boat. Can you meet me with the letters and other trifles? I shall be in the coach which changes horses at the Antelope Hotel at 5:30 Wednesday evening. I shall be wearing a paisley shawl with a red centre, and thus may easily be found. I should prefer this plan of receiving them to having them sent. I remain still yours ever, Lucetta. Henchard breathed heavily. Poor thing, better you had not known me. Upon my heart and soul, if ever I should be left in a position to carry out that marriage with thee, I ought to do it. I ought to do it indeed. The contingency that he had in his mind was, of course, the death of Mrs. Henchard. As requested, he sealed up Lucetta's letters, and put the parcel aside till the day she had appointed. This plan of returning them by hand being apparently a little ruse of the young lady for exchanging a word or two with him on past times. He would have preferred not to see her, but deeming that there could be no great harm in acquiescing thus far, he went at dusk and stood opposite the coach-office. The evening was chilly, and the coach was late. Henchard crossed over to it while the horses were being changed, but there was no Lucetta inside or out. Concluding that something had happened to modify her arrangements, he gave the matter up and went home, not without a sense of relief. Meanwhile Mrs. Henchard was weakening visibly. She could not go out of doors any more. One day, after much thinking, which seemed to distress her, she said she wanted to write something. A desk was put upon her bed with pen and paper, and at her request she was left alone. She remained writing for a short time, folded her paper carefully, called Elizabeth Jane to bring a taper and wax, and then, still refusing assistance, sealed up the sheet, directed it, and locked it in her desk. She had directed it in these words, "Mr. Michael Henchard, not to be opened till Elizabeth Jane's wedding day." The latter sat up with her mother to the utmost of her strength night after night.
To learn to take the universe seriously, there is no quicker way than to watch, to be a waker, as the country people call it. Between the hours at which the last toss-pot went by, and the first sparrow shook himself, the silence in Casterbridge, barring the rare sound of the watchman, was broken in Elizabeth's ear only by the timepiece in the bedroom, ticking frantically against the clock on the stairs, ticking harder and harder, till it seemed to clang like a gong. And all this while the subtle-souled girl asking herself why she was born, why sitting in a room and blinking at the candle, why things around her had taken the shape they wore in preference to every other possible shape, why they stared at her so helplessly, as if waiting for the touch of some wand that should release them from terrestrial constraint, what that chaos called consciousness, which spun in her at this moment like a top, tended to and began in. Her eyes fell together. She was awake, yet she was asleep. A word from her mother roused her. Without preface, and as the continuation of a scene already progressing in her mind, Mrs. Henchard said, "You remember the note sent to you and Mr. Farfrae, asking you to meet someone in Durnover Barton, and that you thought it was a trick to make fools of you?"
"Yes."
"It was not to make fools of you. It was done to bring you together. 'Twas I did it."
"Why?"
said Elizabeth with a start.
"I wanted you to marry Mr. Farfrae."
"Oh, mother!" Elizabeth Jane bent down her head so much that she looked quite into her own lap. But as her mother did not go on, she said,
"What reason?" "Well, I had a reason, 'twill out one day. I wish it could have been in my time. But there, nothing is as you wish it. Henchard hates him."
"Perhaps they'll be friends again," murmured the girl.
"I don't know. I don't know."
After this her mother was silent and dozed, and she spoke on the subject no more. Some little time later on, Farfrae was passing Henchard's house on a Sunday morning, when he observed that the blinds were all down. He rang the bell so softly that it only sounded a single full note and a small one, and then he was informed that Mrs. Henchard was dead, just dead, that very hour. At the town pump there were gathered when he passed a few old inhabitants who came there for water whenever they had, as at present, spare time to fetch it, because it was purer from that original fount than from their own wells. Mrs. Cuxham, who had been standing there for an indefinite time with her pitcher, was describing the incidents of Mrs. Henchard's death, as she had learnt them from the nurse. "And she was white as marble stone," said Mrs. Cuxham. "And likewise such a thoughtful woman, too. Ah, poor soul, that he minded every little thing that wanted tending. 'Yes,' says she, 'when I'm gone and my last breath's blowed, look in the top drawer of the chest in the back room by the window, and you'll find all my coffin clothes, a piece of flannel that's to put under me, and the little pieces to put under my head, and my new stockings for my feet. They are folded alongside, and all my other things. And there's 4-ounce pennies, the heaviest I could find, a-tied up in bits of linen, for weights, 2 for my right eye, and 2 for my left,' she said. 'And when you've used 'em, and my eyes don't open no more, bury the pennies, good souls, and don't ye go spending 'em, for I shouldn't like it. And open the windows as soon as I am carried out, and make it as cheerful as you can for Elizabeth Jane.'"
"Ah, poor heart!"
"Well, and Martha did it, and buried the 1-ounce pennies in the garden. But if you'll believe words, that man, Christopher Coney, went and dug 'em up, and spent 'em at the Three Mariners. 'Faith,' he said, 'why should death rob life of 4-pence? Death's not of such good report that we should respect them to that extent,' says he."
"'Twas a cannibal deed," deprecated her listeners.
"Gad, then I won't quite hay it," said Solomon Longways. "I say it to-day, and 'tis a Sunday morning, and I wouldn't speak wrongfully for a silver 6-pence at such a time. I don't see no harm in it.
To respect the dead is sound doxology, and I wouldn't sell skeletons, leastwise respectable skeletons, to be varnished for anatomies, except I were out of work. But money is scarce, and throats get dry. Why should death rob life of fourpence? I say there was no treason in it.
Well, poor soul, she's helpless to hinder that or anything now, answered Mother Cuxsom. And all her shining keys will be took from her, and her cupboards opened, and little things they didn't wish seen, anybody will see, and her wishes and ways will all be as nothing.
End of chapter 18. Chapter 19 of The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Bruce Peary. Chapter 19. Henchard and Elizabeth sat conversing by the fire. It was 3 weeks after Mrs. Henchard's funeral. The candles were not lighted, and a restless, acrobatic flame poised on a coal called from the shady walls the smiles of all shapes that could respond. The old pier-glass with gilt columns and huge entablature, the picture-frames, sundry knobs and handles, and the brass rosette at the bottom of each ribboned bell-pull on either side of the chimney-piece.
"Elizabeth, do you think much of old times?" said Henchard.
"Yes, sir, often," she said.
"Who do you put in your pictures of 'em?"
"Mother and father. Nobody else, hardly."
Henchard always looked like one bent on resisting pain when Elizabeth Jane spoke of Richard Newson as father.
"Ah, I am out of all that, am I not?" he said.
"Was Newson a kind father?"
"Yes, sir, very."
Henchard's face settled into an expression of stolid loneliness which gradually modulated into something softer.
"Suppose I had been your real father," he said. "Would you have cared for me as much as you cared for Richard Newson?"
"I can't think it," she said quickly. "I can think of no other as my father except my father."
Henchard's wife was dissevered from him by death, his friend and helper Farfrae by estrangement, Elizabeth Jane by ignorance. It seemed to him that only one of them could possibly be recalled, and that was the girl. His mind began vibrating between the wish to reveal himself to her and the policy of leaving well alone, till he could no longer sit still. He walked up and down, and then he came and stood behind her chair, looking down upon the top of her head. He could no longer restrain his impulse.
"What did your mother tell you about me, my history?" he asked.
"That you were related by marriage."
"She should have told more, before you knew me. Then my task would not have been such a hard one. Elizabeth, it is I who am your father, and not Richard Newson. Shame alone prevented your wretched parents from owning this to you while both of 'em were alive."
The back of Elizabeth's head remained still, and her shoulders did not denote even the movements of breathing. Henchard went on.
"I'd rather have your scorn, your fear, anything than your ignorance. 'Tis that I hate. Your mother and I were man and wife when we were young. What you saw was our second marriage. Your mother was too honest. We had thought each other dead, and Newson became her husband."
This was the nearest approach Henchard could make to the full truth. As far as he personally was concerned, he would have screened nothing. But he showed a respect for the young girl's sex and years worthy of a better man. When he had gone on to give details which a whole series of slight and unregarded incidents in her past life strangely corroborated, when, in short, she believed his story to be true, she became greatly agitated, and, turning round to the table, flung her face upon it, weeping.
"Don't cry, don't cry," said Henchard, with vehement pathos. "I can't bear it. I won't bear it. I am your father. Why should you cry? Am I so dreadful, so hateful to 'ee? Don't take against me, Elizabeth Jane," he cried, grasping her wet hand.
Don't take against me. Though I was a drinking man once and used your mother roughly, I'll be kinder to you than he was. I'll do anything if you will only look upon me as your father." She tried to stand up and comfort him trustfully, but she could not. She was troubled at his presence, like the brethren at the avowal of Joseph. "I don't want you to come to me all of a sudden," said Henchard in jerks and moving like a great tree in a wind. "No, Elizabeth, I don't. I'll go away and not see you till to-morrow, or when you like, and then I'll show you papers to prove my words. There, I am gone, and won't disturb you any more. 'Twas I that chose your name, my daughter. Your mother wanted it Susan. There, don't forget 'twas I gave you your name." He went out at the door and shut her softly in, and she heard him go away into the garden. But he had not done. Before she had moved or in any way recovered from the effect of his disclosure, he reappeared. "One word more, Elizabeth," he said. "You'll take my surname now, hey? Your mother was against it, but it will be much more pleasant to me. 'Tis legally yours, you know, but nobody need know that. You shall take it as if by choice. I'll talk to my lawyer. I don't know the law of it exactly. But will you do this? Let me put a few lines into the newspaper that such is to be your name." "If it is my name, I must have it, mustn't I?" she asked.
Well, usage is everything in these matters."
"I wonder why mother didn't wish it."
"Oh, some whim of the poor soul's. Now get a bit of paper and draw up a paragraph, as I shall tell you. But let's have a light."
"I can see by the firelight," she answered. "Yes, I'd rather."
"Very well."
She got a piece of paper, and bending over the fender, wrote at his dictation words which he had evidently got by heart from some advertisement or other, words to the effect that she, the writer, hitherto known as Elizabeth Jane Newson, was going to call herself Elizabeth Jane Henchard forthwith. It was done, and fastened up, and directed to the office of the Casterbridge Chronicle. "Now," said Henchard, with the blaze of satisfaction that he always emitted when he had carried his point, though tenderness softened it this time, "I'll go upstairs and hunt for some documents that will prove it all to you. But I won't trouble you with them till to-morrow. Good night, my Elizabeth Jane." He was gone before the bewildered girl could realize what it all meant, or adjust her filial sense to the new center of gravity. She was thankful that he had left her to herself for the evening, and sat down over the fire. Here she remained in silence, and wept, not for her mother now, but for the genial sailor Richard Newson, to whom she seemed doing a wrong. Henchard, in the meantime, had gone upstairs. Papers of a domestic nature he kept in a drawer in his bedroom, and this he unlocked. Before turning them over, he leant back and indulged in reposeful thought. Elizabeth was his at last, and she was a girl of such good sense and kind heart that she would be sure to like him. He was the kind of man to whom some human object for pouring out his heart upon, were it emotive or were it choleric, was almost a necessity. The craving of his heart for the re-establishment of this tenderest human tie had been great during his wife's lifetime, and now he had submitted to its mastery without reluctance and without fear. He bent over the drawer again and proceeded in his search. Among the other papers had been placed the contents of his wife's little desk, the keys of which had been handed to him at her request. Here was the letter addressed to him, with the restriction, "not to be opened till Elizabeth Jane's wedding day." Mrs. Henchard, though more patient than her husband, had been no practical hand at anything. In sealing up the sheet, which was folded and tucked in without an envelope, in the old-fashioned way, she had overlaid the junction with a large mass of wax without the requisite undertouch of the same. The seal had cracked, and the letter was open.
Henchard had no reason to suppose the restriction one of serious weight, and his feeling for his late wife had not been of the nature of deep respect. "Some trifling fancy or other of poor Susan's, I suppose," he said, and without curiosity he allowed his eyes to scan the letter. "My dear Michael, for the good of all three of us, I have kept one thing a secret from you till now. I hope you will understand why. I think you will, though perhaps you may not forgive me. But, dear Michael, I have done it for the best. I shall be in my grave when you read this, and Elizabeth Jane will have a home. Don't curse me, Mike. Think of how I was situated. I can hardly write it, but here it is. Elizabeth Jane is not your Elizabeth Jane, the child who was in my arms when you sold me. No, she died 3 months after that, and this living one is my other husband's. I christened her by the same name we had given to the first, and she filled up the ache I felt at the other's loss. Michael, I am dying, and I might have held my tongue, but I could not. Tell her husband of this or not, as you may judge, and forgive, if you can, a woman you once deeply wronged, as she forgives you. Susan Henchard." Her husband regarded the paper as if it were a window-pane through which he saw for miles. His lips twitched, and he seemed to compress his frame as if to bear better. His usual habit was not to consider whether destiny were hard upon him or not, the shape of his ideals in cases of affliction being simply a moody, "I am to suffer, I perceive. This much scourging, then, it is for me." But now, through his passionate head, there stormed this thought, that the blasting disclosure was what he had deserved. His wife's extreme reluctance to have the girl's name altered from Newson to Henchard was now accounted for fully. It furnished another illustration of that honesty in dishonesty which had characterized her in other things. He remained unnerved and purposeless for near a couple of hours, till he suddenly said, "Ah, I wonder if it is true." He jumped up in an impulse, kicked off his slippers, and went with a candle to the door of Elizabeth Jane's room, where he put his ear to the keyhole and listened. She was breathing profoundly. Henchard softly turned the handle, entered, and, shading the light, approached the bedside. Gradually bringing the light from behind a screening curtain, he held it in such a manner that it fell slantwise on her face without shining on her eyes. He steadfastly regarded her features. They were fair, his were dark, but this was an unimportant preliminary. In sleep there come to the surface buried genealogical facts, ancestral curves, dead men's traits, which the mobility of daytime animation screens and overwhelms. In the present statuesque repose of the young girl's countenance, Richard Newson's was unmistakably reflected. He could not endure the sight of her, and hastened away. Misery taught him nothing more than defiant endurance of it. His wife was dead, and the first impulse for revenge died with the thought that she was beyond him. He looked out at the night as at a fiend. Henchard, like all his kind, was superstitious, and he could not help thinking that the concatenation of events this evening had produced was the scheme of some sinister intelligence bent on punishing him. Yet they had developed naturally. If he had not revealed his past history to Elizabeth, he would not have searched the drawer for papers, and so on. The mockery was that he should have no sooner taught a girl to claim the shelter of his paternity than he discovered her to have no kinship with him. This ironical sequence of things angered him like an impish trick from a fellow creature. Like Prester John's, his table had been spread, and infernal harpies had snatched up the food. He went out of the house and moved sullenly onward down the pavement
till he came to the bridge at the bottom of the High Street. Here he turned in upon a by-path on the river bank, skirting the northeastern limits of the town. These precincts embodied the mournful phases of Casterbridge life, as the south avenues embodied its cheerful moods. The whole way along here was sunless, even in summertime. In spring, white frosts lingered here when other places were steaming with warmth, while in winter it was the seed-field of all the aches, rheumatisms, and torturing cramps of the year. The Casterbridge doctors must have pined away for want of sufficient nourishment, but for the configuration of the landscape on the northeastern side. The river, slow, noiseless, and dark, the Schwarzwasser of Casterbridge, ran beneath a low cliff, the two together forming a defense which had rendered walls and artificial earthworks on this side unnecessary. Here were the ruins of a Franciscan priory, and a mill attached to the same, the water of which roared down a back-hatch like the voice of desolation. Above the cliff and behind the river rose a pile of buildings, and in the front of the pile a square mass cut into the sky. It was like a pedestal lacking its statue. This missing feature, without which the design remained incomplete, was in truth the corpse of a man, for the square mass formed the base of the gallows, the extensive buildings at the back being the county jail. In the meadow where Henchard now walked, the mob were wont to gather whenever an execution took place, and there, to the tune of the roaring weir, they stood and watched the spectacle. The exaggeration which darkness imparted to the glooms of this region impressed Henchard more than he had expected. The lugubrious harmony of the spot with his domestic situation was too perfect for him, impatient of effects, scenes, and adumbrations. It reduced his heart-burning to melancholy, and he exclaimed, "Why the deuce did I come here?" He went on past the cottage in which the old local hangman had lived and died, in times before that calling was monopolized all over England by a single gentleman, and climbed up by a steep back lane into the town. For the sufferings of that night, engendered by his bitter disappointment, he might well have been pitied. He was like one who had half-fainted and could neither recover nor complete the swoon. In words he could blame his wife, but not in his heart. And had he obeyed the wise directions outside her letter, this pain would have been spared him for long, possibly for ever, Elizabeth Jane seeming to show no ambition to quit her safe and secluded maiden courses for the speculative path of matrimony. The morning came after this night of unrest, and with it the necessity for a plan. He was far too self-willed to recede from a position, especially as it would involve humiliation. His daughter he had asserted her to be, and his daughter she should always think herself, no matter what hypocrisy it involved. But he was ill-prepared for the first step in this new situation. The moment he came into the breakfast-room, Elizabeth advanced with open confidence to him and took him by the arm. "I have thought and thought all night of it," she said frankly, "and I see that everything must be as you say, and I am going to look upon you as the father that you are, and not to call you Mr. Henchard any more. It is so plain to me now. Indeed, father, it is. For, of course, you would not have done half the things you have done for me, and let me have my own way so entirely, and bought me presents, if I had only been your stepdaughter." He, Mr. Newson, whom my poor mother married by such a strange mistake—Henchard was glad that he had disguised matters here—was very kind, oh, so kind, she spoke with tears in her eyes. But that is not the same thing as being one's real father after all. Now, father, breakfast is ready, she said cheerfully. Henchard bent and kissed her cheek. The moment and the act he had prefigured for weeks with a thrill of pleasure, yet it was no less than a miserable insipidity to him now that it had come. His reinstation of her mother had been chiefly for the girl's sake, and the fruition of the whole scheme was such dust and ashes as this. End of chapter 19. Chapter 20 of The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Bruce Peary. Chapter 20. Of all the enigmas which ever confronted a girl, there can have been seldom one like that which followed Henchard's announcement of himself to Elizabeth as her father. He had done it in an ardour and an agitation which had half carried the point of affection with her. Yet, behold, from the next morning onwards his manner was constrained as she had never seen it before. The coldness soon broke out into open chiding. One grievous failing of Elizabeth's was her occasional pretty and picturesque use of dialect words, those terrible marks of the beast to the truly genteel. It was dinner-time, they never met except at meals, and she happened to say, when he was rising from table, wishing to show him something, "If you'll bide where you be a minute, father, I'll get it." "Bide where you be?" he echoed sharply. "Good God, are you only fit to carry wash to a pig-trough that ye use such words as those?" She reddened with shame and sadness. "I meant, stay where you are, father," she said in a low, humble voice. "I ought to have been more careful." He made no reply, and went out of the room. The sharp reprimand was not lost upon her, and in time it came to pass that for Fay she said succeed, that she no longer spoke of Dumbledores, but of humble bees, no longer said of young men and women that they walked together, but that they were engaged, that she grew to talk of Greggles as wild hyacinths, that when she had not slept she did not quaintly tell the servants next morning that she had been Hagrid, but that she had suffered from indigestion. These improvements, however, are somewhat in advance of the story. Henchard, being uncultivated himself, was the bitterest critic the fair girl could possibly have had of her own lapses, really slight now, for she read omnivorously. A gratuitous ordeal was in store for her in the matter of her handwriting. She was passing the dining-room door one evening and had occasion to go in for something. It was not till she had opened the door that she knew the mayor was there in the company of a man with whom he transacted business. "Here, Elizabeth Jane," he said, looking round at her, "just write down what I tell you, a few words of an agreement for me and this gentleman to sign. I am a poor tool with a pen." "Be jowned, and so be I," said the gentleman. She brought forward blotting-book, paper, and ink, and sat down. "Now then, an agreement entered into this 16th day of October. Write that first." She started the pen in an elephantine march across the sheet. It was a splendid, round, bold hand of her own conception, a style that would have stamped a woman as Minerva's own in more recent days. But other ideas reigned then. Henchard's creed was that proper young girls wrote ladies' hand. Nay, he believed that bristling characters were as innate and inseparable a part of refined womanhood as sex itself. Hence, when, instead of scribbling, like the Princess Ida, in such a hand as when a field of corn bows all its ears before the roaring east, Elizabeth Jane produced a line of chain-shot and sandbags, he reddened in angry shame for her, and peremptorily saying, "Never mind, I'll finish it," dismissed her there and then. Her considerate disposition became a pitfall to her now. She was, it must be admitted, sometimes provokingly and unnecessarily willing to saddle herself with manual labors. She would go to the kitchen instead of ringing, not to make Phoebe come up twice. She went down on her knees, shovel in hand, when the cat overturned the coal-scuttle. Moreover, she would persistently thank the parlour-maid for everything, till one day, as soon as the girl was gone from the room, Henchard broke out with, "Good God, why doesn't leave off thanking that girl as if she were a goddess born? Don't I pay her a dozen pound a year to do things for ye?"
Elizabeth shrank so visibly at the exclamation that he became sorry a few minutes after, and said that he did not mean to be rough. These domestic exhibitions were the small, protruding needle rocks which suggested rather than revealed what was underneath. But his passion had less terror for her than his coldness. The increasing frequency of the latter mood told her the sad news that he disliked her with a growing dislike. The more interesting that her appearance and manners became under the softening influences which she could now command, and in her wisdom did command, the more she seemed to estrange him. Sometimes she caught him looking at her with a lowering invidiousness that she could hardly bear. Not knowing his secret, it was cruel mockery that she should for the first time excite his animosity when she had taken his surname. But the most terrible ordeal was to come. Elizabeth had latterly been accustomed of an afternoon to present a cup of cider or ale and bread and cheese to Nance Mockridge, who worked in the yard wimbling hay bonds. Nance accepted this offering thankfully at first, afterwards as a matter of course. On a day when Henchard was on the premises, he saw his stepdaughter enter the hay barn on this errand, and as there was no clear spot on which to deposit the provisions, she at once set to work arranging two trusses of hay at the table, Mockridge meanwhile standing with her hands on her hips, easefully looking at the preparations on her behalf. "Elizabeth, come here," said Henchard, and she obeyed. "Why do you lower yourself so confoundedly?" he said with suppressed passion. "Haven't I told you it 50 times, hey? Making yourself a drudge for a common workwoman of such a character as hers? Why, you'll disgrace me to the dust." Now these words were uttered loud enough to reach Nance inside the barn door, who fired up immediately at the slur upon her personal character. Coming to the door, she cried, regardless of consequences, "Come to that, Mr. Henchard, I can let he know she've waited on worse." "Then she must have had more charity than sense," said Henchard. "Oh, no, she hadn't. 'Twere not for charity, but for hire, and at a public-house in this town." "It is not true," cried Henchard indignantly. "Just ask her," said Nance, folding her naked arms in such a manner that she could comfortably scratch her elbows. Henchard glanced at Elizabeth Jane, whose complexion, now pink and white from confinement, lost nearly all of the former color. "What does this mean?" he said to her. "Anything or nothing?"
"It is true," said Elizabeth Jane, "but it was only—"
"Did you do it or didn't you? Where was it?"
"At the Three Mariners, one evening for a little while when we were staying there."
Nance glanced triumphantly at Henchard and sailed into the barn, for, assuming that she was to be discharged on the instant, she had resolved to make the most of her victory. Henchard, however, said nothing about discharging her. Unduly sensitive on such points by reason of his own past, he had the look of one completely ground down to the last indignity. Elizabeth followed him to the house like a culprit, but when she got inside she could not see him, nor did she see him again that day. Convinced of the scathing damage to his local repute and position that must have been caused by such a fact, though it had never before reached his own ears, Henchard showed a positive distaste for the presence of this girl not his own whenever he encountered her. He mostly dined with the farmers at the market-room of one of the two chief hotels, leaving her in utter solitude. Could he have seen how she made use of those silent hours, he might have found reason to reserve his judgment on her quality. She read and took notes incessantly, mastering facts with painful laboriousness, but never flinching from her self-imposed task. She began the study of Latin, incited by the Roman characteristics of the town she lived in. "If I am not well informed, it shall be by no fault of my own," she would say to herself through the tears that would occasionally glide down her peachy cheeks when she was fairly baffled by the portentous obscurity of many of these educational works. Thus she lived on, a dumb, deep-feeling, great-eyed creature,
construed by not a single contiguous being, quenching with patient fortitude her incipient interest in Farfrae because it seemed to be one-sided, unmaidenly, and unwise. True that for reasons best known to herself she had, since Farfrae's dismissal, shifted her quarters from the back room affording a view of the yard, which she had occupied with such zest, to a front chamber overlooking the street. But as for the young man, whenever he passed the house, he seldom or never turned his head. Winter had almost come, and unsettled weather made her still more dependent upon indoor resources. But there were certain early winter days in Casterbridge, days of firmamental exhaustion which followed angry southwesterly tempests, when, if the sun shone, the air was like velvet. She seized on these days for her periodical visits to the spot where her mother lay buried, the still-used burial-ground of the old Roman British city, whose curious feature was this, its continuity as a place of sepulture. Mrs. Henchard's dust, mingled with the dust of women who lay ornamented with glass hairpins and amber necklaces, and men who held in their mouths coins of Hadrian, Posthumus, and the Constantines. Half-past 10 in the morning was about her hour for seeking this spot, a time when the town avenues were deserted as the avenues of Karnak. Business had long since passed down them into its daily cells, and leisure had not arrived there. So Elizabeth Jane walked and read, or looked over the edge of the book to think, and thus reached the churchyard. There, approaching her mother's grave, she saw a solitary dark figure in the middle of the gravel walk. This figure, too, was reading, but not from a book, the words which engrossed it being the inscription on Mrs. Henchard's tombstone. The personage was in mourning, like herself, was about her age and size, and might have been her wraith or double, but for the fact that it was a lady much more beautifully dressed than she. Indeed, comparatively indifferent as Elizabeth Jane was to dress, unless for some temporary whim or purpose, her eyes were arrested by the artistic perfection of the lady's appearance. Her gait, too, had a flexuousness about it, which seemed to avoid angularity. It was a revelation to Elizabeth that human beings could reach this stage of external development. She had never suspected it. She felt all the freshness and grace to be stolen from herself on the instant by the neighborhood of such a stranger. And this was in face of the fact that Elizabeth could now have been writ handsome, while the young lady was simply pretty. Had she been envious, she might have hated the woman, but she did not do that. She allowed herself the pleasure of feeling fascinated. She wondered where the lady had come from. The stumpy and practical walk of honest homeliness which mostly prevailed there, the two styles of dress thereabout, the simple and the mistaken, equally avouched that this figure was no Casterbridge woman's, even if a book in her hand resembling a guide-book had not also suggested it. The stranger presently moved from the tombstone of Mrs. Henchard and vanished behind the corner of the wall. Elizabeth went to the tomb herself. Beside it were two footprints distinct in the soil, signifying that the lady had stood there a long time. She returned homeward, musing on what she had seen, as she might have mused on a rainbow or the northern lights, a rare butterfly or a cameo. Interesting as things had been out of doors, at home it turned out to be one of her bad days. Henchard, whose 2 years' mayoralty was ending, had been made aware that he was not to be chosen to fill a vacancy in the list of aldermen, and that Farfrae was likely to become one of the council. This caused the unfortunate discovery that she had played the waiting maid in the town of which he was mayor to rankle in his mind yet more poisonously. He had learnt by personal inquiry at the time that it was to Donald Farfrae, that treacherous upstart, that she had thus humiliated herself. And though Mrs. Stannage seemed to attach no great importance to the incident,
the cheerful souls at the Three Mariners having exhausted its aspects long ago. Such was Henchard's haughty spirit that the simple, thrifty deed was regarded as little less than a social catastrophe by him. Ever since the evening of his wife's arrival with her daughter, there had been something in the air which had changed his luck. That dinner at the King's Arms with his friends had been Henchard's Austerlitz. He had had his successes since, but his course had not been upward. He was not to be numbered among the aldermen, that peerage of burghers, as he had expected to be, and the consciousness of this soured him to-day.
"Well, where have you been?" he said to her with off-hand laconism.
"I've been strolling in the walks and churchyard, father, till I feel quite leery." She clapped her hand to her mouth, but too late. This was just enough to incense Henchard after the other crosses of the day.
"I won't have you talk like that," he thundered. "Leery, indeed. One would think you worked upon a farm. One day I learn from you that you lend a hand in public houses, then I hear you talk like a clodhopper. I'm burned. If it goes on, this house can't hold us two."
The only way of getting a single pleasant thought to go to sleep upon after this was by recalling the lady she had seen that day, and hoping she might see her again. Meanwhile Henchard was sitting up, thinking over his jealous folly in forbidding Farfrae to pay his addresses to this girl who did not belong to him, when, if he had allowed them to go on, he might not have been encumbered with her. At last he said to himself with satisfaction, as he jumped up and went to the writing-table,
"Ah, he'll think it means peace and a marriage portion, not that I don't want my house to be troubled with her, and no portion at all."
He wrote as follows:
"Sir, on consideration, I don't wish to interfere with your courtship of Elizabeth Jane, if you care for her. I therefore withdraw my objection, excepting in this, that the business be not carried on in my house. Yours, M. Henchard. Mr. Farfrae."
The morrow, being fairly fine, found Elizabeth Jane again in the churchyard, but while looking for the lady she was startled by the apparition of Farfrae, who passed outside the gate. He glanced up for a moment from a pocket-book in which he appeared to be making figures as he went. Whether or not he saw her, he took no notice, and disappeared. Unduly depressed by a sense of her own superfluity, she thought he probably scorned her, and, quite broken in spirit, sat down on a bench. She fell into painful thought on her position, which ended with her saying, quite loud, "Oh, I wish I was dead with dear mother!" Behind the bench was a little promenade under the wall, where people sometimes walked instead of on the gravel. The bench seemed to be touched by something. She looked round, and a face was bending over her, veiled but still distinct, the face of the young woman she had seen yesterday. Elizabeth Jane looked confounded for a moment, knowing she had been overheard, though there was pleasure in her confusion. "Yes, I heard you," said the lady in a vivacious voice, answering her look. "What can have happened?" I can't tell you," said Elizabeth, putting her hand to her face to hide a quick flush that had come. There was no movement or word for a few seconds. Then the girl felt that the young lady was sitting down beside her. "I guess how it is with you," said the latter. "That was your mother." She waved her hand towards the tombstone. Elizabeth looked up at her as if inquiring of herself whether there should be confidence. The lady's manner was so desirous, so anxious, that the girl decided there should be confidence. "It was my mother," she said, "my only friend."
"But your father, Mr. Henchard, he is living."
"Yes, he is living," said Elizabeth Jane. "Is he not kind to you?" "I've no wish to complain of him." "There has been a disagreement." "A little."
"Perhaps you were to blame," suggested the stranger.
"I was, in many ways," sighed the meek Elizabeth. "I swept up the coals when the servants ought to have done it, and I said I was leery, and he was angry with me."
The lady seemed to warm towards her for that reply.
"Do you know the impression your words give me?" she said ingenuously. "That he is a hot-tempered man, a little proud, perhaps ambitious, but not a bad man."
Her anxiety not to condemn Henchard while siding with Elizabeth was curious.
"Oh, no, certainly not bad," agreed the honest girl, "and he has not even been unkind to me till lately, since mother died. But it has been very much to bear while it has lasted. All is owing to my defects, I dare say, and my defects are owing to my history."
"What is your history?"
Elizabeth Jane looked wistfully at her questioner. She found that her questioner was looking at her, turned her eyes down, and then seemed compelled to look back again.
"My history is not gay or attractive," she said, "and yet I can tell it, if you really want to know."
The lady assured her that she did want to know, whereupon Elizabeth Jane told the tale of her life, as she understood it, which was in general the true one, except that the sale at the fair had no part therein. Contrary to the girl's expectation, her new friend was not shocked. This cheered her, and it was not till she thought of returning to that home in which she had been treated so roughly of late that her spirits fell. "I don't know how to return," she murmured. "I think of going away. But what can I do? Where can I go?"
"Perhaps it will be better soon," said her friend gently, "so I would not go far. Now, what do you think of this? I shall soon want somebody to live in my house, partly as housekeeper, partly as companion. Would you mind coming to me? But perhaps—"
"Oh, yes," cried Elizabeth, with tears in her eyes. "I would indeed. I would do anything to be independent, for then perhaps my father might get to love me. But, ah—"
"What?"
"I am no accomplished person, and a companion to you must be that."
"Oh, not necessarily."
"Not? But I can't help using rural words sometimes, when I don't mean to."
"Never mind, I shall like to know them."
"And, oh, I know I shan't do," she cried with a distressful laugh. "I accidentally learned to write roundhand instead of lady's hand. And, of course, you want someone who can write that."
"Well, no."
"What, not necessary to write lady's hand?" cried the joyous Elizabeth.
"Not at all."
"But where do you live?"
"In Casterbridge, or rather I shall be living here after 12 o'clock to-day,"
Elizabeth expressed her astonishment.
"I have been staying at Budmouth for a few days while my house was getting ready. The house I am going into is that one they call High Place Hall, the old stone one looking down the lane to the market. Two or three rooms are fit for occupation, though not all. I sleep there to-night for the first time. Now, will you think over my proposal and meet me here the first fine day next week, and say if you are still in the same mind?"
Elizabeth, her eyes shining at this prospect of a change from an unbearable position, joyfully assented, and the two parted at the gate of the churchyard.
End of chapter 20.